Hi, my name is Judy. You're about to hear the first episode of my thesis podcast, Listening to Fire Knowledges. I just wanted to say at the beginning that this episode includes some difficult and emotional discussions, including conversations about the impact of colonization and residential schools on First Nations families. It also includes a conversation about the dangers of fighting wildfires. So make sure to take care of yourself and listen when you're ready. Thanks for being here.
The good fire part is, you know, in the springtime, in the fall time, in the winter time, getting rid of the fuel and being ready for that summertime. And in our dry climate, things just don't rot. They just stay there on the ground. So it's made to burn, like over thousands and thousands of years. It was burned, and you can burn it in a good way, or it's gonna burn in a bad way. You know, you pick your poison or pick your medicine.
So it's May 4th. We are burning. Joe's way over there in the orange. And we burned around some Saskatoon bushes earlier. I talked about how those are ones that definitely are happy to regenerate with fire. It's pretty special, like seeing what the fire's doing.
Yeah, my name's Joe Gilchrist. My father was Michael Kenny Simon. His nickname was Kenny, from Skeetiston. And my mother is from Ashcroft, and her name is Linda Barra. I have a lot of family from the Clackamas territory, and of course the Shikwemeq.
When did you feel like you became a firekeeper?
I think because when I was younger, I wasn't a good communicator. I was just like, go, 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 and, you know, do, do, do kind of a thing, right? You know, and then once you slow down and once you start to look around, and you're more of a communicator, and you see the value in that everybody else has this knowledge, and you're able to listen to what they're saying. You know, and my, of course, background is fire, because that's how I grew up. And so if somebody tells me, yeah, I remember, you know, however long ago, we used to burn that hill there, because, you know, in the springtime, then this would happen, and we would get our medicine and stuff like that. I said, oh, well, you know, I can help you with that. I can do that. Yeah. And especially if it's on Indian Reserve right now, you know, I can go there and I can burn it in the springtime. And not only would their medicine come up, but the grass would be greener, you know, and the wood ticks would be killed, and the deer would go there. They would have their babies because, you know, the wood ticks are down, the brush is down, they could see the coyotes and the cougars and stuff coming. And I think that's when I became a firekeeper, is just being able to say, yeah, I can do this, and I can listen to your stories, and I could make fire happen in a safe way.
I got in touch with firekeeper and former wildland firefighter Joe Gilchrist through a group called the Salish Firekeeper Society. This is one group in the southern interior of what most of us now know as British Columbia that is bringing together First Nations people who have inherited knowledge and memories about using fire on this landscape. Joe grew up seeing fire, using fire, and fighting fire in the southern interior of BC.
I started firefighting when I was 15 years old.
Wow.
We actually used fire when I was young, about 6 and 7 years old. We were burning fields and burning hunting grounds under the direction of elders. For me back then, I was mostly getting water and stuff together, but I could still remember like running through flames and stuff like that when the fields, the wind would change and stuff like that. We were burning fields. We did an interview not too long ago with the elder, and she talked about when she was young, before she went to residential school. And she talked about their family using fire for the medicine and food that they were getting, and that it hasn't been burned for 60 years or so, because after they went to residential school, everything was kind of lost and connections were broken and stuff like that. And I asked her where these places were that I would go and I would burn it for her, you know, and bring it back. But she was young, and she said that she would fall asleep on the way there, because they were riding in on a wagon, a horse-drawn wagon, and she would fall asleep. So she said she didn't know where it was, and so we have to work with her to bring that back. And these medicines, we hope, and food, we hope that the seeds, you know, that are still in the ground waiting for a fire are still good when we do the burn, and we could bring it back.
Good cultural burns are not something that just anyone can do. Firekeeping is a form of expertise that comes from detailed and deep, inherited and practical knowledge. Joe and I talked about how the healthy time to burn in the spring varies with elevation and type of ecosystem.
Say if you're talking about Okanagan Lake in the low area, when the time the snow leaves and the grass dries out, if you bend down and you pick up the grass, the brown grass, and it crunches in your hand and it's ready to burn, up until the buds start coming out of the trees, that's your window of burning. The other thing that just came to my mind was the burn ban. You know, sometime a burn ban comes on and you're not allowed to burn anymore, but it's set at all elevations. So most of the time, you know, you start burning when the snow leaves, and at different elevations, you burn at different times of the year, which goes into the summertime, because during the summer, these places dry out higher up. Also depends on the slope and aspect and stuff like that also. So, you know, in the summertime, you would do high elevation burns. But the burn ban comes on something, I can't remember, April, May, something like that. And then you're not allowed to burn it at the elevations. But the traditional burning happened, you know, up in the higher elevations for medicine and animals and stuff too, right? So, and foraging.
You'll hear more from Joe throughout this podcast. The research I did and the interviews I conducted took me outside of the Okanagan Valley, like my trip to the Nicola Valley to record that cultural burn with Joe and the Salish Firekeepers Society. But the seeds of this research were planted here, in this valley. It has felt important to me to investigate what fire means and has meant in this specific place, to try to locate and share stories that are most relevant to those of us living on this land. As many of us who have lived and visited here know, the Okanagan Valley is full of beautiful, biodiverse life. It extends from the U.S. border to just north of Armstrong along the Okanagan River and its network of vast, welcoming lakes. Grasslands at the valley bottom turn into dry ponderosa pine and Douglas fir forests as we move up in elevation and go northward in the valley. These ecosystems have been home to all kinds of beings that have shaped and been shaped by the fire ecology of this place, including people.
My English name, or my given name, Pierre Kruger. My family on my mother's side, come from Chilhicha. My family on my father's side comes from Nahumption. Our family is firekeepers. It goes back 10, 20, 30 thousand years. And our family burnt all over the country, right up till 1978. My dad was still alive. We burnt all over the place.
This is a 2019 recording of Penticton Indian Band firekeeper and former firefighter Pierre Kruger speaking about his fire knowledge and experience from an episode of the Good Fire podcast. I did not have the opportunity to speak with him or other Sealk firekeepers, but listening to the knowledges that they have shared in published recordings and writings has been central to my learning about fire here on the unceded territory of the Sealk Okanagan people. This included reading about the teachings of Pierre's mother, the late Annie Kruger, firekeeper for the Penticton Indian Band before him. As I learned about cultural burning in the Okanagan, the Penticton Indian Band came up again and again as being leaders in sustaining and practicing Sealk fire stewardship knowledge today. Like Joe Gilchrist, Pierre Kruger has both firekeeping knowledge and firefighting experience, and they both describe cultural burning as a way of taking care of the land, like tending a big garden. You can hear more about Pierre's knowledge and experience in the full interview on the Good Fire podcast.
There's lots of things to learn to be a firekeeper, because that firekeeper is really also responsible for our garden. All those mountains and the valleys, our garden. We're also responsible for the water runoff. So we've been taught a lot of things, how to read the birth water, how to make sure a fire can only go so far.
The fires were undertaken with tremendous knowledge and attention to detail in terms of the weather, the moisture in the air, the wind on the coast here, even the tides had something to do with, and the actual seasons. So they wouldn't burn just any time, but there's very specialized knowledge that went with these fires. I'm Nancy Turner. I'm an ethnobotanist and ethnoecologist. I've been working here in British Columbia for over 50 years now with traditional knowledge holders from Indigenous nations around British Columbia mostly, learning from them and studying their relationships with plants and the environment.
I reached out to Dr. Turner after reading her paper, Time to Burn. Over decades, she has carefully built relationships with Indigenous elders in BC to protect and share Indigenous knowledges of the environment, including in and around the Okanagan Valley. Fire came up again and again as part of elders' stories about caring for and cultivating their homelands.
Everywhere I went in British Columbia, elders would talk about how long ago they used to burn over areas, and that made everything so much more productive. One of the most influential pieces that I learned about was a story that was told by Lilwa Elder Baptist Ritchie called Burning Mountainsides for Better Crops in English. And this was a story that he originally told to linguist Leon Swoboda, and he himself translated his story into English from the Tlatlimoch or Lilwa language. In this story, he talks about how people would burn the mountainsides, and after they did that a few years later, the berries were really productive, and the root vegetables too, the yellow glacier lily and the tiger lily and the mountain potato or spring beauty corms were enormous compared to what they were before the burn. And then he went on to say how they're not allowed to burn anymore and how people are arrested if they try to start a fire, and how everything has disappeared. And he said there were places we called the berry places, and now you'll not find one single berry there. I should also mention something that I was told by one Okanagan elder, that they would sometimes find a place to burn that was between at the confluence of two creeks coming off the mountains. And they would burn that over, and then they would follow that area for the next 10 years or more. Because at first, there would just be grass coming up, and then that was really good grazing area for deer. Browse for deer. And so the hunters would go to that burned over area to get deer. And then after a while, the berry bushes would start to come up, and the wild strawberries and the other food plants, the root vegetables would grow. And that's when people would go and get those foods. And then after, then it was a cycle that repeated itself. And so I see that happening. It's like creating different patches at different successional stages all over the territory of people. So there, at any one time, there would be such a diversity of different stages from the very initial succession with just grassland and prairie right up to dense tree cover and everything in between. And at different elevations as well to support different plant growth.
The one person I didn't talk about yet is my great aunt, who did go to residential school, but only for maybe a few months or maybe 1 year, because she ended up getting sick in residential school, and it was so bad that they thought that she was going to die. You know, she went deaf and blind, and you know, was on her deathbed when she was only like 6 years old, and so the residential school thought that she was going to die, so she went home, and they sent her up to healing place between Kamloops and Merritt, and she stayed there for, she said, 3 months, and she was underneath. She had to be in the dark, and there was First Nations healers and stuff there, and then she didn't go back to residential school. She stayed with the elders and learned the stories. And when I was 12, I started to go back to my culture and start to talk to my aunts and stuff, and I was asking too many questions and stuff, and they said, well, you should go and see your great aunt and talk to her. She, you know, she did all this, like I just told you. She has all this knowledge that you want to hear. So I did, and I spent I think around 10 years going back and forth to see her. I would go there, listen to their stories, that she'd have other elders and stuff there from the area. I would be leaving, and it would be daylight the next day. So I was like there for 8 or 9 hours. And it felt like I was only there for like 1 or 2 hours. You know, it was pretty crazy. Kind of like how I'm talking, you know. So they would, you know, they would tell stories about burns and some of the medicines, because sage is a medicine, wild rose bushes, you know, there's mint, there's wild potatoes, there's all these medicines that are enhanced by fire, you know. And then if you can't if you can't burn it, then you know, it just sits and it waits for a fire, or it moves into areas where it can grow, but you know, it's not as healthy without fire. In the past, entire mountains were burned in rotation. So 1 year one mountain would burn, the next year another mountain would burn, and another mountain and another mountain all around the area. And different medicines grew in different elevations and at different times of the season, and all, you know, all kinds of stuff. And all, and that's where I was saying that the matriarchs kept that knowledge and where things were, and if fire needed to be added, or when things needed to burn, and how hot, and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, now I see what you mean about, like, we didn't just light from the road and have it come up here, we're doing it in layers.
Yeah. So the next layer, I'll go in there and come out again over here.
Yeah. What reserve are we on right now?
Cold water, Indian Reserve.
Cold water.
Naklakamuk Nation.
Naklakamuk Nation. I have been using English place names when I talk about the Okanagan. But of course, these places have names and stories and fire cultures that long precede the dominance of English. English and other European languages came with fur traders winding north up the Columbia to the Okanagan River in the early 1800s. Gold brought more settler traffic in the late 1850s and 1860s, and with these settlers, new ways of understanding fire. So much changed for life and fire in the Okanagan Valley in the last half of the 19th century. Sealk homelands were cut in half in 1846. By the political boundary line dividing Canada and the United States, there was a horrible epidemic. In the 1860s, smallpox killed many Sealk people at the same time that more settlers were converging in and staying on Sealk homelands, lands that were never given or sold to the settler colonial government that was taking control of the valley. Sealk communities were confined to designated reserve lands to live on, as the wider valley was declared to be the property of settlers and the crown. Cultural burning practices and the power of fire to sustain a diversity of native plant and animal life were not understood or prioritized by settler society, intent on farming, ranching, timber, and other economies of the land. There were new sources of summer ignitions, like sparks from railway lines, which caused large fires. Fire was still used purposefully by some settlers. Fire was used to clear land for cultivation, and some ranchers made the connection between light burning and sustaining grasslands for livestock. But the culture of extensive spring and fall burns, conducted with close attention to the health of plants, animals, and spiritual and cultural resources for people, became more and more limited as Sealk peoples were confined to reserves, and settlers paid different kinds of attention to the land.
About 100 years ago, people decided that recurring forest fires were a bad thing. We did everything we could to stop them. One would think that ending forest fires would create a safe haven for our friend the pine tree. But in fact, the opposite is true. Without the 7 to 20 year cycle of fires, natural parklands and grasslands grew thick with trees. All the dead and dying trees, along with the needles and duff that accumulated on the ground, are fuel that is ready to burn.
That was a clip from the television series Westland from the BC Ministry of Forests, an episode that aired in 2004. What is now the BC Wildfire Service was formed in 1912 as part of the BC Forest Branch to take on the task of controlling fire in the province. Their work included putting out fires, managing fire hazards, and deciding who could light fires. As described in a 1945 report, the BC Wildfire Service strove to be, quote, an organization so equipped and manned that every fire is spotted immediately when it starts and is extinguished. Every Holocaustic conflagration is, in its incipiency, small enough to be crushed beneath a man's heel, end quote. a recent paper on the history of BC fire governance from scholars in the UBC Faculty of Forestry drew my attention to this quote. Their research also drew my attention to a casual term some management officials have used to describe the agency's fire suppression strategies: the boys and the toys. This term struck me as both funny and true, a compact acknowledgement of the male-dominated firefighting workforce and the increasingly refined firefighting equipment they employed to keep fires from spreading. From airplanes to advancing technologies of weather prediction and communication, the boys and the toys of fire suppression have been a defining culture of fire in the Okanagan and across the province in the 20th century. The Tree Ring Lab that produced this fire governance study also contributed an important study of Okanagan Valley fire history a few years ago. Using tree cores and forest structure analysis in the area around Vassall Lake, UBC master's student Alexandra Pogue found that Sealk Okanagan burning practices shaped the patterns of burning in the study area, and that settler colonial fire cultures created a significant departure from those historical fire patterns after 1860. She found that these results aligned with Sealk oral histories and firekeeping knowledge. Scientific and historical approaches to studying fire in and around the Okanagan continue to align with the stories First Nations knowledge keepers have shared. My conversations with people who know fire have helped me continue to ask, how have patterns of fire shifted over the last two centuries in this valley? And what consequences do those shifts have for fires today? How have these changes in patterns of burning and fire suppression affected what we think of as a normal Okanagan landscape?
The dry valleys of the southern interior, if you look at the Okanagan, the Similkameen, the Kettle River Valley, the Columbia River Valley over in the East Kootenays, and the Nicola Valley and the Upper Fraser and the Thompson River Valley, all of those valley bottoms are what we call natural disturbance type 4, which means that historically they experience frequent low-intensity fire. And that notion is really not very old. We have abundant evidence now, scientifically verified, peer-reviewed evidence and so on, of this historical fire return that really stopped quite abruptly in about somewhere between 1860 and 1880. I'm Don Gayton, and probably more appropriate to call me a grassland ecologist rather than a forest ecologist, but that's kind of the area that I've studied, the grasslands and the dry forests of the southern interior. You had the Bush Fire Act in 1874, I believe it was, made it illegal to start a fire. The Indian reserves were created, settlers moved in, cattle came and consumed some of the fine fuels, created trails that made unintentional fire breaks. Then we went from a period of very little fire to the 20s and 30s during the drought years. We had a couple of real barn burners in various parts of the southern interior. And then, like I say, beginning by 1945, really no fires at all. One of the ways that Western scientists have documented fire history is through the use of fire-scarred trees.
Could you describe the
cookies
that we have in front of us here?
So I'm looking at one large cookie from a stump, actually from the UBCO forest, just a kilometer to the north of us. The trick is to find a tree that has been scarred by a fire, but it wasn't killed by the fire. So it leaves an open, what we call a cat face. The first fire leaves that cat face. Subsequent fires then will scar it, and the tree carries on. It is a way of documenting the historical, what we call the fire return interval. This cookie from UBCO shows me that, say, from prior to 1870, there was a fire somewhere in that forest about every 17 years. Post 1870, there was about a 40-year return interval. And that's somewhat similar to what we find throughout the southern interior and down into Washington State and similar areas where pre-European contact, there was a fire. If you took 1,000 hectares on some hillside, there'd be a fire there every 5 to 35 years somewhere. It might be just a little tiny fire. It might be a full-scale, a conflagration.
Your writing, especially in Okanagan Odyssey, speaks of a love of the Okanagan. I'm new here, and when I kind of was conceiving of this project, I just was trying to understand a lot about what the Okanagan meant to people and, you know, how fire played a role. Could you talk about what the Okanagan Valley is? Like, I'm thinking of your first chapter of, like, even trying to define it and, like, what it's meant to study it.
It's a fascinating valley, and having, you know, driven up on Highway 97 this morning, it's, you know, it's such a cosmopolitan center, and yet as soon as you go out into the backcountry, you feel like you're sort of in a different universe, and so that keeps drawing me in and drawing me in, and then I've got an interest in First Nations history in the Okanagan, the settler history, and then the fire history, which is profoundly significant for us in this valley. The scientific community has kind of opted into it, but the larger society is still completely unaware of this. The fact that these ecosystems burned historically very frequently, and we now have about 80 years of Smokey the Bear saying that all fire is bad, put it out by 10 o'clock. We, as a society, left this to the firefighters, you know, in their very capable hands, and said, we have our lives to lead and we don't want to deal with fire. You deal with it. And now we are experiencing the consequences of 8 decades of fire suppression.
And then the other part of your other question was the western part. I started firefighting when I was 15. We didn't have a lot of money. My stepdad was a carpenter, so, and he said, all I got to do is get on the bus and I can go and fight fire. That was in the 80s. So then after that, I started to fight fire when I was 16, and that was legal then. So our bosses, Tom Lacey and Harry Spahan, Tom Lacey was a non-Native person, but he really believed in the science of First Nations people using fire over thousands of years. And he gave me that as part of my job when I turned full-time, was to study how fire was used and why and when and all that. So around 94, around then, he started to change his thinking that fire wasn't bad, and, you know, there was good fire. And so that thinking, you know, moved to us because he trained us and he told us. And eventually, you know, we started to make our fires in the springtime bigger because he would say that in the springtime the First Nations people burned, and this is why. And when I remembered back to when I was young, and I said, yeah, you know, we did do these burns. Then they started initial attack crews, which was 3-person crews, and I got onto one of those and worked my way up to be a boss. In 1991, the unit crew started, the Type 1 Merritt Fire Devils crew. Mm-hmm. And I was voted the unit crew leader by the other guys. So it used to be, you know, that the Merritt Fire Devils was 100% First Nations, and now it's 75% non-Native.
So, yeah, how did that change the crews to have it be all First Nations?
So our crew, I'll talk about the Merritt Fire Devils unit crew, took pride in our work and the area that we fought fire in, that it didn't relight, and that then cold trail everything, and it just was a lot of pride for the Merritt Fire Devils crew to be the Clackamas and to travel all over Canada and represent, you know, that.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about some of the fires that you remember from the Okanagan.
Yeah, so when I was on the unit crew, the main fire that, of course, is in my memory is the fire in Penticton.
The Garnet Fire, the 94?
Garnet Fire 1994. Yeah, we were the first unit crew on site. We went up the Carmi Valley and started digging guard down to the creek. A frontal pass is a weather system that from a cold front coming by, so there'd be possibility of thunder, lightning, and but mostly it was high winds and wind direction changes that was supposed to come through that day. They had a timing on it, and I can't remember, it was like 10 or 11 o'clock or something like that. So we were waiting for our equipment to show up. Yeah, we were really anxious, and you know, we were actually watching the fire gain intensity as we didn't have the equipment to go into that area to attack it. You could see that the column of smoke was kind of leaning away from us to the south, but you could see the smoke started to stand up, and of course that meant that fire burns uphill. So once the fire is standing up, that it was reversing and it was coming towards us now up the hill. We kept telling them that it was time to go. You know, this was like 15 to 20 minutes before we just left finally. You know, we just said, you know, you stay here and we're going. And to the boss, I said, okay, get everybody to put the saws and put the equipment on this tree here. We're not going to carry any equipment. We're just going to carry our packs and our fire shelters. And there was some people that went to check to see if helipad was still open, and we were going to wait for a helicopter to pick us up. And when we found them, they said, no, that helipad's already on fire. So the fire already wrapped around us and was kind of ahead of us down below, and we were still up the hill from it, and we were running uphill, so we were kind of getting closed in. We got to the next helipad, and it was already on fire, and there was like probably about 2 foot by 3 foot chunks of 4 to 6 inch thick mats of ponderosa pine on fire, landing all around us. And so these big huge mats of burning ponderosa pine needles would just land, and they just go whoomph, and then fires would just immediately start. And we thought about putting our fire shelter, we were on a helipad, but it was fuel all around us, and it was already burned orange already, so it would have been a hot reburn. So we decided that we wouldn't survive if we put our fire shelters up. We took off for the trucks, and we got finally to the last area where it drops down to the trucks, and we kept going, and we got to where our trucks are. Yeah, that was our like second evacuation route. Our first one was burned over right away because the fire went around us. Well, if we would have had our equipment, I'm quite sure that fire wouldn't have, that explosion of fire at that time, I'm pretty sure we could have held it.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about it from just the like sheer logistics of like, we're on this fire, just what it takes to put it out. Because part of me, I think in doing fire research in general, I keep grappling with the fact that like, whenever
the fire crews are really successful at your jobs of like, cool, we suppressed this fire right away. That like creates this bigger problem maybe where, well, isn't that all that dense fuel just a tinderbox waiting to burn in some like future drier somewhere? Like, can we ever have enough equipment to keep up with this like suppress like work? But like I and there must be some kind of middle ground of like, well, we just have to, you know, do something a little bit different. But what do you, does that feel like a tension to you of like every time we're good at our job, we're making a future problem worse or something?
Well, and now when I look back at all, because we had a really high success rate, initial attack in the Merritt Fire Zone, and all the fires that we kept small have now burned over, you know, and I've been in initial attack fires in all those areas, and you know, kept them point size, you know, 0.1 of a hectare or you know, less than 4 hectares initial attack success rate and all the stuff, and now it's all, the whole thing is burned, you know. The First Nations use of fire and burning the fuel, and if we would have burned thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of hectares, I remember my boss saying that a fire zone should burn 100,000 hectares a year, which would mean over the 7 to 15 year period, the whole zone would be burned in a rotation. Which is like an impossibility, you know, like you think about burning 100,000 hectares a year, but that's how it was done, you know, over thousands of years, you know, hundreds of thousands of hectares was burned in around communities.
The Garnet Fire in 1994 was a wake-up call for the Okanagan and the province. The post-fire report called it BC's worst interface fire ever. It destroyed 18 homes and caused 4,000 people to be evacuated. It was evidence that a policy of total fire suppression was leading to more dangerous and difficult-to-control fires. It would not be the last wake-up call for the province or the Okanagan. In the Okanagan Valley, as in other parts of Western North America, many people are calling for more good fire on the land at safe times of year. But we're working within a provincial system that was built to control the use of fire and put almost all fires out. If you've lived in the Okanagan Valley for the past 30 years, chances are you've experienced more bad fires than good fires. Can you introduce yourself the way that you'd like to be introduced on the podcast?
Yeah, sure. So I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Earth, Environmental, and Geographic Sciences, he, him pronouns. I do research in kind of ecology. A lot of that has to do with wildfire and habitat and wildlife and kind of interactions amongst those things. And then, I mean, in the context of what we're talking about, I used to work as a wildland firefighter, so... everybody experience there and just doing lots of research in the valley.
This is Matthew Bourbonnais, who leads the Living with Wildfire project at UBC Okanagan that I've been a part of for the last year. A number of the students in Matthew's Earth Observation and Spatial Ecology Lab are working on projects related to wildfire and fire management in the Okanagan. We spoke about fire across the many different perspectives that he brings to fire research.
As a early 20s kind of guy, it was kind of like, this looks awesome. This looks like super fun. I'm going to jump out of a helicopter, get on the ground. There's going to be flames everywhere. And the job is not like that for the most part. I mean, we, you know, most fires in Canada are tiny, or we manage to keep them tiny. So, you know, sometimes the terminology, you just get out and step on it. Little 0.01 hectare fires that you don't, you just kind of scrape it and it's out. So, you know, going into it though, I had no training in fire ecology. I didn't have any real recognition of its role in like an ecosystem. We didn't learn any of that either. It was, you know, you were a crew in an organization that was mandated to suppress fire. That was your job, and we're pretty good at it. But we also, you know, over time, as you spend more time in the programs, you get involved in more prescribed fire. When I went to Parks Canada, for example, that was the focus a lot of times, was, you know, putting fire back on the landscape. So you learn a lot more of that as you go, if you stick around. So, you know, when I went into grad school, it was kind of interesting. My master's and my PhD research were really focused on grizzly bears in Alberta. It was kind of an eye-opener for me because, you know, you get deep into the literature, you're trying to understand their behavior and all this kind of stuff. And grizzlies in Alberta, they rely a lot on forest disturbance as habitat. It creates, you know, new cereal habitat that oftentimes supports like berries and herbaceous growth, and ungulates will select for it. And as I kind of got into literature, you know, I started realizing that like all those years of putting fires out, I was actually, you know, limiting grizzly bear habitat through this whole area. But it really kind of opened my eyes to, like, as a new researcher, at least, this idea of like fire as like an ecological process that is an important part of a landscape for at least wildlife at the time. You know, now being like a prof with students are, you know, studying this kind of stuff and like kind of coming up with research questions ourselves and things that we're interested in. It's definitely been a shift in that you recognize, or what we're really interested in is kind of understanding how fire can exist within this landscape or within our society that is really focused, at least from a Western perspective, really focused on it being like not a part of the landscape, you know, for 100+ years now. I'd say the other thing too, you know, in this kind of area, we have fire conducive ecosystems. Fire has evolved in this landscape. We have a lot of species, tree species, grasslands that, lack of a better term, they want to burn. You know, ponderosa pine, lodgepole pine, they're fire resistant, but also kind of fire is part of their life cycle as a species. Bunch grass ecosystems, that kind of stuff. We're seeing the same things in the Okanagan that we're seeing in a lot of landscapes, is this like fueling of the landscape. Really high tree densities in certain areas, a lot more forest compared to kind of probably what this landscape would have looked like over 100 years ago, with more grasslands probably. And just a lot more like horizontal and vertical like contiguity or connectivity of those fuels, largely as a result of kind of fire suppression and the removal of like cultural burning that the Silk people practiced for, you know, millennia, and was a big part of how our landscapes were structured here. The thing with fuels is that it's always kind of tempered with like weather and climate. You know, you can have all the fuel in the world, but if it's super wet and it's not really going to burn, or it doesn't have a lot of opportunity to burn or kind of like pick up steam if a fire starts. The challenge we have in the Okanagan is that it's really hot and dry. And so, you know, with climate change predictions and projections and that kind of stuff, we should expect, based on like what we're seeing with fuels, to expect these kind of fires that we're seeing.
For more than a century now, the culture of the BC Wildfire Service has driven decision-making about fire on the land. There have been organizational shifts since the 1970s towards recognizing the ecological importance of fire. But in practice, moving away from a culture of waging technological war on fire has been difficult. I think listening to multiple interdisciplinary fire knowledges is important for unnormalizing a culture of trying to erase fire from the land. In this episode, we heard from Joe Gilchrist, Nancy Turner, Don Gayton, Matthew Bourbonnais, and a recording of Pierre Kruger. We discussed histories and legacies of cultural burning, fire suppression, and fire ecology in and around the Okanagan Valley in the southern interior of British Columbia. In the next episodes, we'll hear from more people reckoning with how to live with and manage the fire-maintained landscapes of the Okanagan Valley in BC, today and for the future.
Did you ever work on any fires in the Okanagan?
Yes. Yeah, of course. As a firefighter in British Columbia, that's like a rite of passage. There's fires in the Okanagan every season, right? It's just an eventuality, right?
There was a period of time when they thought the whole town was going to go up in flames. The whole town.
But I think that fire is like a launching point or staging point for more awareness with the municipalities, the parks, and the government.
So you can see the need for higher level landscape level treatment. Once it starts rolling like it did, it takes a lot more than a 50-100 meter field treatment to stop that.
I'm so excited and happy to see the importance of wildfires is and risk reduction is getting out in the public eye.
There are a lot of ways to keep learning and get connected to the work of living better with fire in the Okanagan Valley in British Columbia. I wanted to mention first off that you can take some really simple actions today to make you and your home a lot safer during a wildfire event. And there's great information on the Fire Smart Canada website about how to do this. That's firesmartcanada.ca. You can take the Fire Smart 101 course online, and you can listen to their podcast called the Get Fire Smart Podcast. And you can read their booklet about Indigenous fire stewardship called Blazing the Trail. There are also ways to get more involved in sustaining and caring for the fire-adapted ecosystems that you live in. Some examples outside of Canada that I look to are the Nature Conservancy's TREX Prescribed Fire Training Exchange in the U.S., the Karuk tribe's work in the Western Klamath in Northern California, the work of prescribed burning associations and cooperatives in the Southern U.S., and the Fire Sticks Alliance in Australia. I'm still figuring out who's doing this public-facing work in and around the Okanagan Valley, and I hope releasing this podcast will help bring interested and active people together. Keep an eye out for ways to support or even start organizations that care about good fire and fire ecology in your community. I, unsurprisingly, love learning about fire through podcasts. A few that I recommend are the Good Fire Podcast, hosted by Amy Cardinal Christensen and Matthew Kristoff. Another one is Amanda Montai's Life with Fire Podcast. And the three episodes about fire ecology from the Vancouver-based Future Ecologies Podcast. You can listen to many of my full interviews on my thesis project website, which is listeningtofirepodcast.ca. You can also find the transcripts of those interviews there and transcripts of each of these episodes that include citations for my research. This research was supported in part by the Government of Canada's New Frontiers in Research Fund through UBC Okanagan's Living with Wildfire Project. A big thank you to Blue Dot Sessions for providing podcasters with a wonderful repository of free music to create with. The music in this episode is all from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Judy Burr. Thanks for listening.